Welcome, everyone, to Midday Magazine for the September 7th, 2023. I have your host, James J. Mailoff here. I am joined by our great friend, Janelle Weir, horticultural educator with UW-Madison Extension, Wood County. Janelle, it's been too long. It's
been... it's funny. We were just talking last week how, it seemed like it was pretty quick, and here I am right back next week.
Appreciate you pitch hitting. Thank you very much for being in with us today, and especially with the topic we're going to get to, because we kind of teased this a little bit already. We're diving into storing tender bulbs for the winter.
Yeah. So it's, with the change in temperature and kind of the weather's working out for me perfectly because the heat finally broke. And so it's time to start thinking about if you have tender bulbs, how are you going to store them over the wintertime? So tender bulbs here, what I'm talking about are caladiums, calla lilies, canna lilies, dahlias, gladiolus, and tuberous begonias. There's some other tender bulbs out there too, but that kind of gives you an idea of what I'm talking about. Now, these are not winter hardy, but the good news is because they have these structures, these bulbs, we can actually store them over the winter, and it's pretty easy to store them. That makes it less expensive, so that way you don't have to replace them every year.
Interesting. So what about how you store them or the digging part of this part?
Yeah, so the first thing you're going to want to do is either dry them down. So if you've got them in containers, you can dry them down. Otherwise, wait until the first frost hits and it kills off the foliage, or maybe a couple of frosts, light frosts. If it's a really light frost, let them get hit by a couple of light frosts. You don't want them staying in the ground once the frost has hit them, though. So as soon as the frost hits, you're going to want to dig them up pretty quickly. Otherwise, you'll start to run into rotting issues inside the ground or inside that container. So what you're going to want to do is just very lightly dig them up, and then you're going to lightly dust off all the dirt off of them. But you want to be careful that you're not damaging. If there's some bulbs have a papery skin on the outside. If it's one of those bulbs that has a papery skin, don't damage that papery skin. If you damage that papery skin, what you're doing is encouraging opportunities for rotting to happen over the wintertime.
How about keeping them clean?
Yeah, so you can dust them off. If you do wash them, you're going to be careful with them again. Again, we're really trying hard not to damage that. We don't want any bruising. Think about them kind of like a fruit, right? So they'll bruise, and if they bruise, well, that's when the rotting's going to happen over the wintertime. So really be careful with them. And if it's the type of bulb that you would divide, so here I'm kind of thinking about dahlia tubers. Go ahead and wait until the spring to divide them. And the reason why, again, is we're trying to avoid having any open wounds. We want to avoid any opportunities for rotting. The real danger over the winter time storing them is there's a real opportunity for them to rot. And so what we're doing is just trying to reduce any opportunities for that.
So what about curry?
Yeah, so what you're going to want to do is now you've got them clean. If you rinse them off really gently, we need to let them dry. Regardless of if you rinse them off with water, you still need to let them dry for a few days. 1 to 3 days is going to be fine for most of your bulbs. Some of them like to dry a little bit longer, though. Here I'm thinking about the calla lilies and the gladiolus. Drying them, you're going to do that really kind of like how you would dry herbs or flowers or anything else. So indirect light, nice dry conditions. If you've got them in a humid spot, it's going to take a lot longer for them to cure. So nice, dry, cool location. And then with gladiolus, because the type of bulb in here, I'm using the word bulb in air quotes, it's actually not a bulb, it's a corm. The only reason why this is particularly important is what you'll notice is there'll be a kind of like a little shriveled structure. That was the mother corm from last year. You can go ahead and just knock that off. And what happens is just the way that the gladiolus reproduces over time. The corm that you plant this year is going to produce next year's corm. Go ahead and knock off. If you've got a shriveled corm on a gladiolus, go ahead and just knock that off.
when it comes to storing this, now all these, steps are vital and important. Certainly the storing part has got to have a little bit more to it and got to be the most vital part of almost.
Yeah. So with storing, you got to be, here's what you're basically doing is, you're going to store them in some sort of material. And the purpose of that material is kind of twofold. Mm. So you want something that is going to both pull moisture if those bulbs are too wet, or if the bulbs are too dry, they're going to give that moisture back to them. So you want some sort of material that's going to moderate moisture. You got a lot of different options. You could use sand. Peat is a great one. Yeah. You could use sawdust. You could even use shredded newspaper. Okay. Any of those materials are going to have that moderating effect with moisture. So what you're going to do is you want some sort of container. You could use a plastic bin, although if you do use a plastic big bin, make sure that you don't keep the top of it sealed. You don't want airtight containers. Honestly, storage boxes are going to be probably best thing that you could use because they're not airtight. They've got some air circulation in there. Remember, the main thing we're trying to do or main thing we're trying to avoid is any rotting. Okay.
Right.
So you could dust the bulbs first with some sort of fungicide. Fungicides come in, so you wouldn't use a liquid one here. You would use one that came as a dust. I think sulfur would probably work really nicely for you. Lightly dust them, kind of like how you would dust a chicken breast if you were making fried chicken, right? So maybe a gallon-sized paper plastic bag or a plastic garbage bag with some of that that fungicide, dust fungicide in there, and just give it a little shake. After that, you're going to want to make sure that you're labeling your bulbs, okay? There's nothing worse than pulling out your bulbs and not knowing, you know, especially if you're potting them up and you want to pot them up into particular arrangements, you're going to want to know not only which one is a begonia, but what color was that begonia, right? So now's the time to get those labels on because you won't remember in the spring. I promise you, you won't. And then you could, how you label them, well, if you're storing them in paper bags, you can just write it right, you know, put it, write it, label it with a Sharpie right on the bag. I've seen people actually label with a fine tip Sharpie right on the bulbs themselves if the bulbs are big enough. So there I'm kind of thinking about like an elephant ear. You know, those tend to be rather large. Or, you know, you can come up with whatever different solutions. Next, you're going to store those bulbs, and the way you're going to do them is you're going to layer that material. Remember, I mentioned like peat or sand, whatever that material it is that you're using. You're going to put about a 2-inch layer on the bottom, and then now you're going to layer your bulbs, okay? You don't want the bulbs to touch each other. If they touch each other, if one of them starts to rot, it's going to cause the other one to rot. They're going to share that. Think about this. The rotting is a disease.
Right.
It's basically what's happening is a plant disease, right? So if they're touching each other, they're definitely going to share that disease. Don't want them to touch each other. Go ahead and put a nice even layer down. Put another layer of that peat moss or whatever that packing material is, a couple of inches deep, and then keep layering them until you've got your container full.
All these steps are important. It's also, it doesn't seem like impossible. It doesn't seem like there's so much to this that I think is so cool that we've gotten to a point in life and society and all that where we can keep these plants, you know, around for a whole year. Now I know they can't be out for display, but the fact that you still have them and can pull them right out again, you don't have to buy new ones. Just the process is fascinating to me. It's interesting.
You know, I had a, I believe it's called a Skagum begonia. So it's a type of a tuberous begonia. And when I first bought the bulb, it was a little bit smaller than my fist. And I had it for several years, probably like 7 or 8 years. When that last year that I pulled it out, I want to say, I'm trying to think of what, it was getting close to the size of a icebox watermelon.
Whoa.
It got big.
Yeah.
It got really big. I mean, it was becoming a challenge every year of, okay, what container am I going to put you in?
That's the first thing I thought. Wow, yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Just that's even possible. I think for a lot of us that I wasn't born with any green, even a black thumb. I mean, I really am learning about this stuff as you and I talk about it. That's awesome. That is really interesting. And I know that my mom does this every year, but I mean, again, I grew up with a woman and I still didn't even catch half of these things that she does. It's interesting. So even when it's that close to home, you don't always get this stuff.
Yeah, my mom had a green thumb, and I didn't know any, like, I wasn't paying attention to anything. You would think that I probably learned from her. No. And it's funny, I think about my kids, and so much of their life I have been working with plants. Do they know a whole lot about plants? You know, the two older ones a little bit more. My oldest probably because she worked with me at a greenhouse. Oh. Youngest, barely is aware that plants exist. I forgot what she told me the other day, but she referred to something as a grass. And it was like a tree or something. I was just like, what did you say?
That's awesome. So one last thing about this, as far as the keep up on keeping an eye on them, checking in on them and everything. Is there any notes on that?
I would just make sure that you're going down in the basement, pulling out your bulbs and just checking to see, number one, are they rotting? If you've noticed that there's a soft spot on any of them, get rid of it. Keep it around. It's just going to continue to get worse. So if you find one that's got a soft spot, yank it. And then my other thought would be take a look at them. And if they seem like they're starting to get a little bit too dry, a little bit too shriveled, very, very lightly mist them and then pack them back inside the packing material.
It's good stuff. Thank you for that. Again, we're speaking with Janelle Weir, horticultural educator for the UW-Madison Extension. And Janelle, well, let's talk about bringing the plants indoors now. We've talked about that process. Now let's get to this part about bringing them in the house.
Yeah, so this is going to be what I was talking about previously, where bulbs that, you know, they're outdoor plants that we keep outdoors for containers or inside the ground. Now what I want to switch gears is if you had house plants that were at summer vacation outside in the backyard all summer, now's the time to start thinking about bringing them in. We still have a couple of weeks before our first frost, but the process of bringing them in, if you don't want them to be really stressed out and drop all of their leaves, you can reduce that stress by starting that process now.
Yeah.
So one of the first things I want to think about is light. Mm. What we're going to do, if you have ever gotten vegetables in the spring from a greenhouse, say like tomatoes, and you hearted them off in the spring by slowly exposing them to more and more light, so that way when you plant them, they don't end up getting a sun scald. What you're going to do is the exact opposite process here. So you're slowly going to gradually give them less and less light. Even if you've got a really, really bright solarium inside your house, it's still going to be less light than if they were in a very shady backyard all summer long, okay? So what you're going to do is, you know, if you've got them in full sun, you're going to just slowly put them someplace where they're going to get a little bit less light over a 2-week period, okay? If they were in a shady spot, gradually bring them into a shadier and shadier spot, okay? So once you've gotten them slowly exposed to less light, when you do bring them inside the house, they're going to lose less leaves. If anybody's out there has ever had a hibiscus, I think a hibiscus is a perfect example for this. If you've ever had a tropical hibiscus and you brought it inside for the winter and you notice like within 10 days it's dropped 90% of its leaves, regrow those leaves. And what's happened is when they do regrow those leaves, they regrow them and the new leaves will be adapted to less light exposure. But if you slowly reduce the light, they'll get adapted over time. So you don't have to go through all of that.
Plants are so smart.
Oh, yeah.
They're so intelligent.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
So that's how you get around, you know, even now I say this. If you do that, please don't call me at the extension office if your hibiscus still loses a couple of leaves. You're still going to lose some leaves. You're just not going to have that shocking 90% leaf drop that you would have if you would have brought it from full sun to your sunny solarium.
You have a line in your notes here, do not bring hitchhikers indoors. It's not very often that we have a good note for humans and plants. It doesn't happen very often. It's funny, but it's also a big part of this process is making sure that there's no pests on the plants.
Absolutely. So once you've gotten the plant adjusted to lower light levels, mm-hmm. now we're at the time we're going to bring them inside, right? Because that was like about a 2-week process that you were reducing
Thank you
light.
For that. I meant to ask how long you should take that with that process.
About a 10 days to 2 weeks. Nice. Yeah, that should be good. So now you've gone through that reduction of light. Now it's time to start thinking about what do I need to do. Bring that plant inside. First thing, you're going to pop that plant. If it's small enough, pop the plant out of the container that it's in. Take a look at the bottom of the pot. Are there any pests, maybe roly-polies down there? Sometimes there's frogs down there or salamanders. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure you're not bringing any surprises in. Take a look at the root ball. Do you have any maybe root mealies or any other insects in there? There might even be centipedes in there, right? Mm. Maybe rinse out the inside of that pot. Make sure that you're not bringing anything inside. And then, you know, what we're going to be doing is kind of just thinking about, you know, we talk a lot about pest management in here, right? When I come on the radio, mm-hmm. we're going to apply those principles to our indoor plants mm-hmm. as well. So we're going to be thinking about the different types of plants that we've got and what pests might they be susceptible to. Mm. I've got a beautiful giant old jade at home. That guy I know is going to end up... hopefully he won't, but he probably will. Might get mealy bugs because he's very, very susceptible to mealy bugs, right? So I'm going to be looking for evidence of mealy bugs on there and try to maybe rinse them off with water really, really well before I bring them inside.
Is that, I imagine it's different per insect, but is that one of the better ways of removing these pests off of there gently or, you know, safely so you're not hurting the plant?
Yes, I would, all of the plants, I would give them a good bath. And what I would do is I would tip them on their sides. So I take them out of the container, tip them on their sides, and rinse the undersides of the leaves with a really gentle stream. Depending on how strong the leaves are, that's how strong the stream of water can be. Okay. Some leaves are going to be, you know, some leaves, if you put a stream of water on them, they'll tear pretty easily, right? Yeah. So you just got to be kind of careful about that. Jade plant, you can be pretty ruthless with, you know, with blasting it with water. All the plants, give them a good rinse with water. This is going to probably knock off anywhere between, I don't know, maybe 75-80% of any eggs or adults that are on there. Now, remember, you know, there's a good chance that, you know, with some pests, you know, if you even bring in a single egg inside, eventually that population will build up. Yeah. I'm thinking about aphids, right? Mm-hmm. So aphid females are born pregnant. Yeah.
What a life.
Yeah, and they give birth to live young. And so all it takes is one female surviving, one female egg surviving. Well, no, they're live young, but one female surviving, that eventually you'll end up with a population. So because of that, what I like to do, you know, for basically all of my non-edible plants that I'm bringing inside, I'll go ahead and give them a systemic insecticide. The way a systemic insecticide works is it... the plant will take it up through the roots and distribute it throughout the entire plant. And it'll protect the plant for about an 8-week period. And I will do this both for my flowering plants and my non-flowering plants. What I'll do is I'll pick the flowers off of my plants while I'm adjusting that light in that 2-week period. I'll give them that systemic insecticide. And then after about 10 days, that should be distributed throughout my entire plant. Then I'll go ahead and bring my plants inside. I'm not too worried about using a systemic insecticide for flowering plants indoors,
right?
Because I don't have pollinators indoors.
So
I can use that without really worrying too much about it. Outdoors, I'm a little bit more judicious about where I use my systemic insecticides, but indoors, I shouldn't have any pollinators.
Yeah, right. And it's nice to know, you know, where they can have these uses, some of those insecticides.
That's one of my favorite applications for systemic insecticides. There's, you know, there's a lot of responsible ways that you can use all sorts of different pesticides. It's just a matter of, you know, thinking through how am I what am I using this for, and what could be a potential unintended target?
When I was a kid, some of the first chores I had was doing laundry when I was about 10 or 12, somewhere in between there. And I'd do laundry, and afterwards, I'd go water my mom's plants. It was pretty easy. I just put my finger in there, feel if the soil's wet. And if it is, if it's dry, I water the plant. That was what she told me. What she didn't tell me was volume and how much water to put in there. And I learned the hard way. I should say my mom's plants learned the hard way that you can't, there's, it's not about, well, it's you put it better here about overwatering. I'll let you word it because I'm sitting here explaining it and you know it better than I do.
So a phrase I often say is overwatering is an issue of frequency. It's not an issue of volume.
God, I wish I'd have been told that. I wish I'd have been told that.
A lot of people think overwater, you know, they're so afraid to overwater. And so what they'll end up doing instead is love the plants to death by giving them a little itty bitty sip of water, yeah. You know, maybe even every day, mm-hmm. right? Well, if you only give it a little bit of water every single day or however often that you water the plant, what's happening, there's two bad things that are happening here. Number one, no matter where your water supply is, if it's rainwater, if you live out in the country and you've got well water, if you live in the city and you've got city water, there's going to be some minerals in that water, okay? It's not, none of us are drinking pure H2O, mm-hmm. right? Unless mm-hmm. we're drinking like reverse osmosis water.
Right, right.
If you only give your plant just a little bit of water, you're going to get a buildup of those minerals at the surface of the plant, okay, right at that top of the layer of the plant. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, you know, we want roots distributed throughout the entire plant, right? So if we're only giving water at the very, very top and we're not actually watering until water comes out of the bottom mm-hmm. of the pot, those roots at the bottom of the pot are never getting access to water. They're starving, right? Mm-hmm. They're never getting that water. And we're really not encouraging the roots to completely develop throughout the entire pot.
That hit my heart. Oh, man, I feel that. I didn't even realize that. Mm.
Yeah, so whenever you water, and this is going to be true for all of your plants in containers. That's why I always say container plants in containers absolutely must have drainage holes. And this is the reason why. Anytime you water a plant, bucket tomatoes, hanging basket of petunias, your dish garden of succulents, water until water comes out of the bottom of the pot.
That's a great one. That's a really good note. I hope everybody else is marking that down because I know I have a mental note about that now. And just talking about this, Janelle, and not trying to get us too into the weeds here or anything, I get that pun. it seems like with a lot of things, we do this with animals a lot too. We tend to think, well, I'm a human being. I need water all the time. My plant probably needs water all the time. We tend to do this like the comparison of, well, what we need and what they need. And I don't know if it's a subconscious thing or not, but it's important to understand that they are not us. That there's a difference between us. And while water is vital for both, you know, groups here, it's a little different with us where we need it more consistently than the plants do. And I know that's probably basic for some out there, but apparently some of us need to be learning this one, you know?
You know, I saw something really hilarious. I can't remember if it was Facebook or where, somewhere on social media, but it was somebody talking about how they loved their plant. It was a little succulent, and they loved it so much that they made a little home for it on their, I want to say it was the middle inside of a car, the section between the driver and the passenger. They made a little home for their plant right there, because they thought that it would make the plant happy. And all I could think to myself was, plants don't have feet. They don't want that constant adjustment of light, you know? You park in the shade, you drive home, it's sunny, it's shade. Like, that has got to be just terrible for that plant.
Yeah. When we talk about this with animals a lot. When you have an animal, it's not about you. It's about the animal. It's about doing right by the animal. If you want to put the, I think it'd be really cute to put this Halloween costume on him. That's for you. The dog or the cat is not interested in wearing that outfit, no matter how much you try to convince yourself of it. It's important to approach these things, plants, animals, any of the above, as it's about them. and what's best for them. And what's best for a plant is not being in a moving vehicle. Like, right. That does not seem to make a lot of sense. It's the opposite of what a plant would want and everything.
Right.
I think a lot of this can be helped if you walk into any of these situations with that. What's best for the plant? What's best for that? This living thing.
You know, that's where pest management, integrated pest management, it's all about thinking about, you know, first, you know, it's about predicting, you know. Yeah. First, you got to understand, okay, what does the plant need? And then predict how can things go wrong. Mm-hmm. You take that approach, you're probably a lot less likely to end up with dead plants.
Wanted to also mention, and we'll talk more about this as we get closer to it, Science by the River coming up September 30th, Saturday. Be sure to be there, everybody. We'll be celebrating this. We'll be talking more and more about it, and we'll meet you down there, Janelle.
Fantastic.
Thanks again for the time. Really appreciate it and love talking with you. Thank you. We'll have more Midday Magazine for you tomorrow right here on WFHR Locally Grown Radio.